But around that time, I was in student school. The school offered a exchange program to Israel under Dr. Kennedy for 3 weeks. And that was right before Y2K. And I was interested to spend some time in Israel to study for 3 weeks in Israel. And so we went as a group of students, we went with the professor to Israel, and we are taking off just around the New Year Eve time before the Y2K. And my parents were real concerned, but then my mother, and including my son, they were concerned. He said, you know, what happened? If the computer failed, the plane may just kind of fell off the sky. And I may never be able to come back. You know, if you go at this time, this critical time, to tell you the truth, my mom was a very calculated person. And I share some of that as a son, you know, inherited. So I'm not aware, I'm not aware of that. In fact, she was living in Houston at that time. She was afraid of not enough water to drink during that time, the Y2K, right, that transitional period. She had two big garbage cans at home. They were clean, fresh, new garbage cans. She filled them up with water. She was afraid there would not be enough water to drink during that time, not be able to get the fresh water. But anyway, my decision at that time and my priority then that I want to go ahead with the trip. For one thing, I know that I was widowed at that time, and I didn't have to worry about, you know,
getting killed.
My son is independent now, and my parents are under care, so I don't have that responsibility to be the burden to somebody if something happened to me. So, but anyway, that is what made my decision, is that is more important for me to take the trip than not to go because the possible inherent danger that might happen during Y2K time. And I'm happy that I did it because that was a rare opportunity for me. So I just want to share that. But yeah. I'm also following his question, Jerry's question. I have a question. Yesterday you mentioned that. Let's say you will have four possibility you right. can choose. And right. they are all fairly equal, similar. And you can pick any one of them, and they will still be reasonable and fair. Let's say not four. Let's say you have two choices in life. They are very important. Let's say job, moving, relocation, so on. Both of these seem to be very attractive. How do you make a decision between the two? You just kind of flip the coin, or how do you do it?
Well, the issue of equal options. You see, I think we come to this question of equal options with the wrong assumption. Our assumption is that we have to have a message from heaven before we choose so we don't make the wrong choice. But what if they're both equal options? You see, I think we come with the wrong presupposition to the question. Let me give you an illustration. God has given us a yard. Let's say the yard were the boundaries of this auditorium. And it's got a fence around it. And God has said, thou shalt play in the yard, but thou shalt not cross the fence. In the yard, there's a tree. In the yard, there's a sandbox. It's my decision whether I'm going to be up the tree or in the sandbox. But as long as I'm in the yard, I'm within God's will. Because God's will is defined by the fence. I'm free to choose where to be in the yard. I can ride my bike around the yard. I can trot. I can play my banjo. I can do any number of things in the yard. And as long as I'm in the yard and following the prescripts of what it means to live in the yard, I'm okay. I have choices. And I make my choices, and I live for God within those choices. Now, if I choose to be up the tree during a thunderstorm, I made a bad choice. If I choose to be in the sandbox after 50 cats have gone through the yard, I made a bad choice. So we make choices on the basis of wisdom within the yard and common sense. If I make a bad choice and I'm up the tree, I'm within the boundaries of God's will, But because of my bad choice, I learn a lesson. And I won't be up the tree in another thunderstorm or with the sandbox. Because sometimes in life, God teaches us more by making an unwise choice within boundaries. Because we get ourselves into something that creates for us a problem. But we learn from our problems. We don't say, well, I should have prayed more, and then I wouldn't have gone up the tree. I don't think that's the point. The point is that I have these equal options, and I make my choice, and I live for God within the choices that I make. And there are different choices that can be made as long as you're inside of the yard. Let's make it more challenging. Say that this would not be wise, but say that I was dating three girls at the same time. They're all three Christians. They all love the Lord. And we have as much compatibility with each other as we can have. Well, which one am I supposed to marry? That's about as important decision as you can make in life. Yeah, okay. Honey, you didn't have to confess that you asked me to marry you. I didn't really want you to do that. The introduction to my book gives an illustration along the lines of our own relationship. And I have to confess in the introduction that I didn't do it the right way, even though the decision ended up being well. That's God's providence. See, God protects us even when we're not so smart. Okay? Now, so I have the choice between the three. And I think the traditional understanding of finding God's will, the Bible never tells us to find God's will. It's not lost. It always tells us to do. So we look at the three. They're all Proverbs 31 kind of women. I mean, they're perfect. Yes, noble character. By the way, that's an alphabetic poem in Proverbs 31. It's from A to Z, if you please. And it's a fascinating statement there in the song, in the proverb. But anyway, so those are three equal options. And let's just assume they all three chose to say yes if I ask. And I have to make a decision. There would be no wrong decision. Oh, yeah. Let me finish. In that sense, there's no wrong decision. Why? Because the Bible tells me, marry a believer, marry a godly woman, and I think we can assume some other things about human relationships. And in a sense, in the moral will of God, there's no wrong decision. Now, God knows ahead of time whom I'll choose. But my processing doesn't say, Lord, I'll choose when I hear you whisper in my ear which one. But I hear a whisper in this ear, and I hear a whisper in this ear. Which is God and which is the devil, you know? And so I think the point, you see, we have misunderstood fundamentally the idea of God's will. God's will is God's teaching. As long as you follow God's teaching, you are in God's will. The rest of it, the geography, the location, is up to God to make sure we get there as we are obedient to Him. He orchestrates the circumstances. Now, sometimes we make a bad choice in the yard, but when all these things are equal, we've made those choices on certain reasons. Now, let's say that I make the choice among the three. Of course, the first thing I'm going to do 5 years later is think about, what if I had married one of the other two? What would life be like? It'd be awful. Okay? Well, the point is this. Once you've made a choice on the basis of correct values, you're committed. And I, many times in my office as a pastor in the past, people would come in and who were having marital problems, and the first thing they would say is, we don't love each other anymore. They have forgotten that love is a commitment, not a feeling. Most people start their marriages on the basis of feelings instead of on the basis of commitments. Your culture may have actually done better when you're smarter parents in the past. Not now. Your smarter parents in the past made a choice for you. You know, arranged marriages, who, maybe that's more God's will than our making an independent choice. Yeah. But the point is this, think of the yard. Think of the yard. And now that every choice will eventually show different idiosyncrasies. But the fact is when the choice is made, that is an acceptable choice, even though there are alternatives, you live with the consequences. All of us have different kinds of choices in life to make. But when we make a choice and it doesn't turn out like we thought it would, our task is not to complain. Our task is not to blame ourselves and thereby kind of subtly blame God. You got me into this mess. Our task is to be a faithful Christian, to bloom, as I mentioned yesterday, where we are planted. And not just to grin and bear it, but to take that responsibility to the point of making it really grow as it ought to. Now, yeah. But isn't it true in life that every choice we make, we have 20/20 vision afterwards? Hindsight, as the proverb goes, hindsight is 20/20. I'm sure no illustration is ever as good as that which it tries to illustrate. But the fact is that we typically, after we're into a decision, we say to ourselves, I didn't really see that ahead of time. Well, good. Now you've learned something. Because I think in God's plan, every decision we make leads us into a new learning experience. Some of those learning experiences are for life. Not too many choices are forever. Not too many choices. Marriage is a forever choice, but not too many choices are forever. Lots of choices. We learn something. Then we back up and punt, like most football teams have to do. You know, you back up and you punt, so you get another opportunity. But then we get into the next situation, and we discover, well, I didn't see all that coming in. But that is part of God's will. God's will is for us to learn from what we find when we get into our choices, as long as our choices are in the backyard. Now, if we got out of the yard, then we haven't listened to God. And not listening to God is out of the will, if you please. But as long as we're in the yard, we're making choices, we're learning. The next time we make a choice, we make a better choice. And that's what glorifies God. You see, it would have been so easy for God to give us that blue phone, a blue cell phone. We phone up God every time we make a choice. But that wouldn't glorify God. God created us thinking, feeling, choosing, determining beings. And when we make choices on the basis of what we know what God wants, as best we can, we glorify God. And yet we constantly learn that maybe we could have made a better choice. We made a good choice, but it wasn't better or not best. We've got good, better, and best going on all the time. And I think what we need to do, instead of complaining about, well, I should have prayed more or something, and maybe we should have, what we need to do is say, thank you, Lord, for teaching me something I would not have learned if I wasn't here. And now I can back up and punt when the time is right and move on to the next learning experience. That's hard to answer because we don't have the direct teaching information about that. Let's think about it from Peter's perspective. Did Lot think when he was looking at the grass, did the thought cross his mind, man, this is a great opportunity to have a singular control of that, and Abram goes somewhere else? And then the thought crossed his mind, but think about that, where you're going. Because the Bible editorially, if you read Genesis carefully, in parentheses it says, and at that time the city was the da-da-da. So that had to be common knowledge. Because the writer brings into this is the narrator of the passage, lets the audience, the reader, know that Lot, I think by right there we could say that Lot knew it was not the place to be. But he overrode that, as we often do in life. We have a value, but another value overrides it. And sometimes we, in our own conscience, in our own self-reflection, say, maybe this is not the best choice, but man, I do want that. I do want that vehicle rather than that other vehicle. And even though it stretches me too much financially right now and I shouldn't do it, I just can't resist. And so we do what we do. We learn, even when the car is getting repossessed and going away, because we couldn't make our payments. We are learning a hard lesson, but that makes us grow as human beings, makes us grow as Christians in the context that we make our decisions. Well, that was hypothetical.
My question is, you need to start something wrong at the very beginning, and then go to God, ask God how to help you to continue. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, of course, I was just trying to illustrate that. Let's, you know, that I wouldn't do that, of course.
Yeah.
How many guys were you dating? How many guys did you date? I'm glad you got Bruce Lee. Yes, you're right. Yeah, that's right. And many times, in my book, introduction to my book, which I'm sure you'll read. Everybody needs a copy. I've sold just under 1 million. Way under. Okay, but anyway. In the opening of the book, I talk about our dating and engagement. We got engaged on our second, or I asked her to marry me on our second date. And she was very wise. She waited 2 days before she said yes. Now, in the book, I confess in the opening to the book that we were both in Bible college. I was sort of a shy person, and I knew that I needed a helpmeet, someone to complement my own downfalls personality-wise. She was the life of the party. When the dorm was dead till she arrived, and it came to life. Not always in a good way, but it came to life. And I said, no, here's somebody who likes people. Well, if I marry them, that'll take care of me, you know. I can have my own quiet life, and she can take care of the people. And this isn't this complimentary? And that was bad, see, because I was trying to look at marriage from the standpoint of covering my problems. And that wasn't a good decision-making process, and that's the purpose of the introduction, to point out it was not a good decision-making process. In fact, it was a very bad one. She told me when we made the decision, she was going to let her parents know. She said, my dad will be here this weekend. He's going to show up, and he did. He was about a foot taller than me and about 10 times meaner. He put me in the front of the car and the family in the back. And for 2 days, we rode around with me getting grilled about this whirlwind engagement. Well, he was right to do that. But here's the interesting piece. I was dumb as a rock about most things about the Bible at that point. But after 2 days of grilling, I didn't know what else to say, so I said to him, we're getting married because it's God's will. He shut up and never asked another question. Who can argue with God? And I make the point in the beginning of the book that many times we use those kinds of phrases to put off conversation, to put off discussion, to have our way and get people off our back. Now, when students come into me and ask a question and tell me that it's God's will for them to do something, my first question is what? Why? Well, I'm not supposed to ask that, right? They pulled out the trump card. God told me. If God told me, then you're supposed to confirm that. But I want to know why you made that decision. Maybe that voice you heard was yourself talking to yourself. And you heard what you wanted to hear. So exactly, we can start down the road of decisions by starting in the wrong way, and dating three would not be wise. One at a time only. It's kind of like a church. If a church is calling a pastor, it's generally not wise to have a succession of two or three speakers and then make a choice. What have you done? You've created a personality conflict. Some people like one, some like another. It's it's better to see those people in their own context or in some context that's not your church. And for those who the church has commissioned to work on finding a pastor, to make some decisions and then and make a pecking order of these individuals and bring them in one at a time, and then you either say yes or no. And then on to the next. Because otherwise, it would get into very difficult situations. So there's an analogy, even though it's not perfect. Okay, good. Okay. And yet it's not forever, isn't it? You know, I would like to say, I don't know anything. I know you've had a change, and I really don't know the details of that, but I carry the union card called clergy. So I can criticize the clergy, all right? In the calling of a pastor, in a pastor's longevity within a church, we would all wish that it would last forever. But first of all, the culture's against that. Our culture is a culture of change. Isn't it? You know, the statistics of a male career, of a man in a job, used to be that my father, for example, would have one career back in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And then a man might have two careers, or at least two major job changes. Now it's 4, 5, 6 major changes in life before one settles in or before it's too late to make another decision. We live in a culture of change. So I think it's a wrong assumption to assume that somebody can come and be there forever, because things do change. People change. Your needs change. Well, there's two things to think about. That is change bad? Did Paul make changes in personnel in his missionary journeys? He did. Well, that's the travels. I'm thinking in terms of personnel. He didn't like the way that John Mark behaved, even though he was the cousin of Barnabas. He didn't meet Paul's expectations and the needs that Paul had, so Paul made a change. It was not easy. And so nothing's absolute. Let's not think in terms of absolute. But we would be like ostriches sticking our head in the sand if we didn't recognize the fact that the challenges that churches have go through certain periods, and there are certain individuals that can take you to the next level. And then it may be wise for them and wise for the church to think about the next issue. You know, there's no way to predict those kinds of things. Uh-huh. No, you're only out of God's will when you violate God's moral will. Well, okay. Like I married for the wrong reason, but married the right woman. I married for a selfish reason. And the Bible says, the Bible teaches against us being self-centered and selfish. So I had a flaw in my decision-making process, but God overruled it. And our own commitment to each other overrules it. We are not very compatible. We like seafood, and that's about the end of our compatibility. And because there's a sense in which decisions are commitments. They're like covenants, contracts. And we're obligated to maintain that. I understand what you're saying, I think, but it's complex, isn't it? It's not simple. And we can't have any generic one illustration that settles everything, because life is never going to be that simple. It's always going to be more complex than we want it to be. So the only, I suppose, in one sense, those core values are what can carry us through life. And while change may not be a core biblical value, mission is a core biblical value. And we fulfill mission in different ways. Paul did that. He fulfilled mission with certain workers at certain times for certain reasons. And we all have to make those choices as well. And so consequently, we do the best we can, as faithfully as we can, covered with an umbrella of prayer. My biggest prayer in life is, Lord, protect me from myself. That's my biggest prayer. Lord, protect me from myself. And sometimes God does, and sometimes God lets me have it my way. And I learned something. It wasn't a moral problem. It was an unwise problem. It was a wrong value problem, even though the value wasn't a moral value in that decision. And I learned something that I could have never learned any other way. And I really want to stress this. Don't push against the circumstances you end up with when you think you made a bad decision. Engage them. Put your arms around them. Learn from them. Because that's how you grow. And at the end of the day, when we all get to heaven and see the video that God has for us about that process, he may say, see what you did right there? See what you did right there? Now bad boy. Bad boy. You didn't sin, but you weren't smart. Now, you should have known better. You know, Nicodemus, you're a ruler in Israel and you don't know these things? Bad boy. But look where you ended up. You'd have never gotten there if you didn't make that decision, even though it wasn't the best one. Because if you hadn't made that decision, you wouldn't have learned this. If you hadn't learned this, you wouldn't be there. We are the people we are based more on our mistakes and based on our successes. You ever think that thought? God builds his work on our mistakes. You cannot dwell on the mistakes. You dwell on the future and making your way better because of the past. That's the only way forward. There's a Southern spiritual song that goes, the only way up is down. The only way up is down. If by the way of the cross you go, the only way up is down. Now that has to do with humbling ourselves before the cross to have God's pleasure. But in life, it's a mess. And no matter how well we may do, it's still many times going to be a mess. But the only way up is down. To humble ourselves, to recognize where we've been strong and where we've been weak, where we've been good, where we've been bad, where we've been right, where we've been wrong, where we've been mostly stubborn. And to say, okay, that's in the past, and it's a fact, but now how can we move forward in the best way possible, having learned from the past? Sometimes we do have to talk about past so that we can learn from it, but we can't dwell on it. We got to move on. I mean, I could give you all kinds of illustrations out of my own journeys in which I end up in a place and realize it's not the best, but it was the secret for the next level of success in terms of personal living. What is our terminus time? 12:30. Okay, I didn't want to violate that, especially if there's lunch. Okay. You know, well, let me give you another illustration. I had a student in a school once that was absolutely convinced that God had told him that a certain girl was supposed to marry him. Now, I should tell you, too, that he came from a culture where male dominance is everything. Okay? But, and he was so fixated on this that we finally had to dismiss him from school. She had to get a restraining order. And for years, I would get phone calls in the middle of night from this student telling me how he just couldn't seem to achieve God's will. But God never told her that. See. So I think that many times we use this construct of God's will to achieve our own purposes, not necessarily to achieve God's. Yes. There would be several discussions. If we the word fill is used in different ways in the Bible. And Samson violated God's will in stark ways. But the Spirit came upon him. And it talks about, in an analogical way, he was full of power. Hey, think of this. John the Baptizer. He wasn't a Baptist. They didn't exist yet. Okay? John the Baptizer was full of the Spirit in his mother's womb. What's that mean? Does that mean he never had to become a believer after he was born and grew up and came to an age where he could make a decision? There, the language of him being full of the Spirit is Old Testament language, merely meaning this: it's a divine event. That's what that language means. Now come over to your passages, and there's one in Colossians 3 about being filled with the Word, that the Word of Christ dwell in you richly. We have to ask ourselves, what does the word fill mean? That's the first question. And this is a very challenging thing, because one of the biggest challenges in relation to the Bible is learning to read religious language. Most religious language is figurative. It's not concrete. It's figurative. Now, let me go on so I can try to explain what I mean. Fill, literally, would be like this morning, I filled my coffee cup with coffee. Okay? You filled yours with tea. And I like tea, but in the morning I've got to have that cup of coffee, you know. And so I filled my cup with coffee. Fill with the Spirit, filled with the Word, the other passage you mentioned, that's not the way to explain fill in that context. It's not that you get more of the Spirit. That's not a good explanation of the metaphor. See, fill is a metaphor. Just like led by the Spirit occurs two times, Romans 8 and Galatians 5 in the Bible. Be led by the Spirit. Led is a metaphor. What's that mean? Put your hand in the hand of the man who walks on the water? Is that what led means? No. In those two contexts, Romans 8 and Galatians 5, they're context of sanctification, developing holiness. To be led by the Spirit means to live a holy life. You live a holy life, people see you, they can say that the Spirit's at work in your life. It's not getting anything else, not any other information, but that. Okay, led, metaphor. Fill is a metaphor. And so what does it mean to be filled with the Spirit? Yesterday, I explained this from Acts 26 or 28, where Dorcas, who was a woman, a fine Christian woman in the book of Acts, the King James Version, and sometimes language of Bible translation presents some challenges here, but the literal translation is she was full of good works. Okay? Dorcas was full of good works. What did that mean? There was a good work sticking out here, and a good work sticking out here, and a good work sticking out here like Santa Claus's bag of toys. No, we know that, don't we? So we have to engage the nature of language. We know now that the word fill with Dorcas is not literal in the sense of fill a cup with water. It's a metaphor. And in fact, if you look at translations, and I have a lecture on how to use the English Bibles. The lecture is called So Many Bibles, So Little Time. And the proliferation of English Bibles is a problem, but it can be a blessing if you understand the nature of Bibles and translation. Sometime maybe I can come and share that with you. But the fact is a lot of Bibles will translate these kinds of passages and take away that language of filled with good works, and the NIV does that very thing. In fact, listen, well, is it 28, 26? I need to find that passage to read it for you, and I don't know if I can, I know the territory. I'm in the right ballpark, but I better find the right pew here. Where we have Dorcas. I don't know if I have it marked. I don't think I do, so I'm at a little bit of a loss. I can find it faster in Greek than I can find it in English. By the way, if you're wondering, this is what you put on the side of station wagons. You know, I've covered this thing a couple of times. But anyway, get the reference here, because I want you to see this. This understanding. 936. Yeah, it was a lot earlier, wasn't it? 936. All right, now, the literal translation of the Greek for 936 is that Dorcas was full of good works. Now, listen to the way the NIV translates it. Now, what's the difference between the King James and the NIV? The King James is a literal translation. It's as literal as possible, as free as necessary. I could show you places in the King James where they have to be as free as necessary, because no two languages are exactly the same. Translators have to make decisions. The King James people made decisions, so do the modern. That's a literal translation. The RSV is a literal translation. The NASB is a literal translation. The NIV was the first of the Bibles that came out for what we call dynamic equivalence, which means they tried to render it the thought rather than just the words to make it easier to read. The best test of this is Romans 7. Read Romans 7 in the King James, and then read Romans 7 in the NIV. In the King James, Romans 7 is the dooby-dooby-doo chapter. What I want to do, I can't do. What I don't want to do, I find myself doing. By the time you get to the end of that chapter, you're tied up in a knot. You don't know which way to go. It's very difficult, literally. But when you read a dynamic equivalent translation, it helps you to understand. Okay? Now, as a translator, as one who works in the languages, I have a lot of problems with modern translations because they get in my way. But just to give you an illustration, here's how they translate full of good works. Dorcas, this is an NIV, I hope. I think it is. I pick up whatever Bible I grab going out to Rome sometimes. Who was always doing good and helping the poor. Always doing good. Translates full of good works. So they rendered it so that you would get the point of what they were saying about Dorcas. Because full of good works is a metaphor for meaning she was always doing good. Let's think one more thing about Dorcas. Should we say that Dorcas was controlled by good works? That'd be a negative idea, wouldn't it? In other words, she wasn't controlled by God, but she was controlled by good works. She's like Martha and Mary. Martha, Martha, you're so busy about so many things. Can you? It's fun to go back with a little imagination and see these scenes of Mary sitting there not helping in the kitchen. And here's Martha busy and around, you know. Mary is worshiping. Martha's preparing the meal. Jesus says, oh, Martha, you're so worried about so many different things. She was controlled by good works. I'm glad Martha was preparing meals, you know. But control's not a good idea. But think of this word for the word fill in these kinds of passages. Characterize. Martha was characterized by good works. That's what characterized her life. She helped people. She had the gift of help. Now take that over to your passages. What does it mean to be filled with the Spirit? Thank you. Full of. See? Right. It sort of doubles it up, doesn't it? It doubles it up because I understand your Chinese Bible is a translation of the King James. So you have what I would call a literal translation of a translation. Okay? But think about this. Let's go to the next level. When we ask, what does it mean to be filled with the Spirit? Many times the answer is, you need to be controlled by the Spirit. So now we move into our mystical mode, waiting to get zapped. Waiting for something to happen that sort of picks us up and says we're controlled. I think that's a bad explanation of the metaphor. I think Dorcas is a better explanation. What does it mean to be filled with the Spirit? It means to be characterized. To be characterized by the things that the Spirit teaches us. And in this passage, it teaches us to be thankful. In everything, give thanks. Singing, making melody in your hearts to the Lord. Submitting to one another. Those three things. In fact, I diagrammed it. If you were here yesterday, I diagrammed it. Those are all participles. They're actually explaining the verb. They're telling you what it means to be filled. So when you're being thankful, when you're praising God in your life sincerely, and when you're pursuing in the community ways of moving forward that respects other people, submitting to one another, that's what that means, that respects other people, you are demonstrating that the Spirit of God is at work in your life. Because the evidence of your life matches what the Bible says will be true if the Spirit is in control. So I think the real challenge is understanding this language feel, understanding the metaphor. That's the hardest thing to do. Otherwise, you have an almond joy reading of the Bible. It's indescribably delicious, but we don't know what it means. We're waiting for it to happen. But that's not Paul. That's not Paul. Yes. I have a friend who wrote a 60-page paper on your very question. Okay? And so I know the options. There's different ways to describe it. But at the end of the day, no matter which of the choices you make, the bottom line is this. The giving thanks, singing, making melody in your hearts to the Lord, and submitting to one another is the evidence of the work of the Spirit in a person's life. When you're characterized that way, you're characterized by the right thing. And then when you look at Colossians, which is a parallel, to be filled with the Word means to be characterized by the teaching of Scripture. Nobody ever wonders about that one, see? Because it's when we get filled with Spirit that we get into trying to deal with what does this language mean. One more, and I think we... Let me give you just one sentence that I think captures the work of the Spirit. I'll give you one word. Make it easy. You know what my one word is that captures the work of the Spirit in your life? Conviction. Conviction. The work of the Spirit is to convict you that this is important. You need to know what it says. You need to obey it. The work of the Spirit is not to give you any content. You already got it. The work of the Spirit is to make you get serious about the content. And that's the conviction. Yes, you're the last.